There's so many great Kinnison stories at the store. It's so unfair that guys like Sam have to die so young and a son of a bitch like Nelson Mandela live to be an old man. Well, Nelson Mandela wasn't a son of a bitch. He fought apartheid, and they put him in prison for more than 20 years. And when they finally released him and he took power, he never exacted revenge on his enemies. Instead, he exacted forgiveness on them and brought his torn nation together. I thought he stole some diamonds. No. Didn't he steal a bunch of diamonds and then sell them back to the guy he stole them from? No. Well, who am I thinking of then? I don't know. Let's get back in the car now. It's cold in the desert. I don't like it in the middle of the desert late at night. I know this is when the creatures emerge. They spend their days hiding from the merciless sun behind rocks and cactus, and it's when the sun goes down that they make their living. In the black of night, I can hear them, hungry, scrabbling over the rocks. And I look over at Adam Egget, but he's looking down, lost, the way a man looks when there's nothing but darkness around him, and the only thing that will help is a deep, deep swig from a bottle. Of course, Adam Egget lost the bottle 5 years ago, and now he has nothing. Makes me feel bad. Sorta. Come on, Adam Egget, let's move. We'll stop at the border, Whiskey Pete's. We'll eat fried bread and molasses while I tell you the plan. How's that sound to you? You'll tell me the plan, Norm? You'll tell me what this is all about? Yeah, sure I will. If you want to know, I'll tell it to you. I want to know, Norm. I want to know the plan. That makes me laugh. I don't dare fall asleep in the car now. Adam Egget looks seriously unnerved, and the highway from L.A. to Vegas is scarred every few miles by black rubber, the last evidence of tumbling, burning cars. But I'm the passenger, and my job is to keep the driver relaxed and happy, and that means telling them more stories. Stories from the old days. Chapter 8, Starting Out. You got boots? I suppose I had heard that line from Charlie 100 times. He never looked up at me, though, so I don't think he ever saw my face. Yes, sir, I got boots. I'd take a seat with the rest of the boys in the middle of the room, and we'd play euchre or hearts, nothing too hard. I was convinced some of the boys, like Billy Saunders, weren't there for a day's work at all, but just wanted company. I never heard the sound of Billy's boots hitting the floor when Charlie called out a job for the day. That was all right, though. More work for me. I specialized in unskilled labor, and I was good at it. Skilled labor appealed to a different sort. It was for the thinking men. Men who liked to use their heads as much as their bodies. I didn't like to use my head, but I loved unskilled manual labor. That kind of work let my mind alone. Let it be free. If my job was to shovel and shovel until 8 hours had passed, then my body worked on its own. It had no use for my mind. So my mind would take off to a world of imagination. And that's where stand-up comedy started. One morning I sat at the card table with the boys and told them a funny idea that had come to my idle mind as my body had been busy at the jackhammer. It concerned answering machines, and everybody around the table got a big laugh from it. From then on, as I worked, I would let my mind flow toward a comic place, committed to making the boys at the card table laugh the next day. I was 21 in 1984 when Mark Breslin opened Yuck Yuck's Comedy Club in Ottawa. I was making $21.20 a day for Charlie, and Mark was offering $15 a set. A set took about 5 minutes, and you could do 2 a night if you were lucky. So the decision was pretty easy. And never once did Mark Breslin ask me if I had boots. Mark owned branches of Yuck Yucks all across Canada, and Howie Wagman was and still is the manager of the Ottawa Club. Howie helped me with the ins and outs of comedy. I'll never forget my first line on a stand-up stage. How many of you guys own answering machines? To this day, it remains one of my strongest lines. I quickly developed a cult following. That sounds pretty good, but the truth is it's the last thing you want to develop. The only time having a cult following is a great thing is when you are actually in a cult. Then you get to be a cult leader, and life is milk and honey. First off, everyone thinks you are God, so you get to tell them all what to do. Your followers bow down before you and give you all their worldly goods, which can really add up, even with a smallish cult. The best part is, you get to lie down with all the ladies from the cult, even the married ones. In a short matter of time, you become drunk with power and begin to lie down with the men also, not because you want to, but just because you can. Yes, being a cult leader with a cult following is fine work if you can find it. However, being a stand-up comedian with a cult following just means that most folks hate your guts. Chapter 9, My Greatest Gig. Tell me another story, Norm. Tell me about the greatest gig you ever did. Well, that's easy, Adam Egan. See, a comedian never forgets his greatest gig. But the details slip away with time. And the devil is in the details, and so is God. So I pick up a brand new Surette and fill it with grains and grains of morphine and puncture the flesh between my middle and ring finger. Give myself a large dose, because this memory is long in the past. When the drug hits hard, the present is gone, along with the white Challenger, but there's a red Datsun in its place. It is 1985, and I am a young man who's done stand-up comedy for only a year, and I'm driving to a gig all by myself. The beautiful opioid allows me to see this all as if it had happened yesterday, and not 10,000 yesterdays ago. I'd gotten a gig doing comedy at a hospital for the patients. It didn't pay any money. That's not why a comic does a gig like that. You take that type of gig just because you want to be a good person and receive eternal life. Son of a bitch, the drive was long. Why they built a hospital so damn far away from everybody, I couldn't figure. It was way out in the middle of northern Ontario, where you have to pray your car doesn't break down. And if it does, you have to pray you freeze to death before the timber wolves find you. Well, the people who built it must have known what they were doing. After all, they owned a hospital, and I was just some guy in a car asking questions to myself. Suddenly, in the middle of nothing, where the infinite nothing of the sky meets the infinite nothing of the snow, I saw something. It was a small, square, blue sign, a sign indicating a hospital ahead. It may as well have read, Last Chance for Heart Attack for 300 Miles. I was getting close, and getting nervous, too. Maybe it was the barbed wire around the perimeter. Or maybe it was the armed guards. What kind of a hospital was I playing, anyway? I got my answer quick enough, because it was written on a big sign. Hospital for the Criminally Insane. My agent had never been big on details. It took me a while just to get into the place. First they patted me down and took all my weapons and my drugs. Then they looked up my ass and took those weapons and those drugs as well. But finally, they let me go, from the outside to the inside. "Take me to the warden," I demanded. "This is a hospital, son. There's no warden." "Oh, fine, then take me to the entertainment director." We walked down a long corridor, filled with howls of anguish and high, wailing screeches. Every cage I passed had a guy in it, and every guy was acting odder than the last. The first guy was scratching his hair real hard, even though it was shorn close, like he was trying to scratch inside his head or something. And he just kept saying, "I was at John D. Rockefeller's funeral." Then the next guy was just staring at me, stone still, and he had a big smile on his lips, but his eyes were cold dead. I started laughing to beat hell. "How do you work with these characters all day and not crack up?" I asked the orderly. "Oh, you get used to it." "What about the guy with the cold dead eyes standing there?" I asked. "What'd he do to get in here?" "Oh, his name's Fred Henshaw. He took his mother out to the cold northern tundra, where the sun never sets, and he cut off her eyelids. That way she couldn't sleep or even shield her eyes from the sun. Then Fred had her wander around, tripping in the snow, falling, getting back up, falling again. Every day Fred would take a hypodermic needle and remove half a pint of blood from the old lady. After about a week, his mother just lay down on the hard snow. Then he sat down and waited for the crows to come." "Oh, my God, that's the worst thing I've ever heard of. What about the guy before him? Mr. Itchyhead, what did he do? Oh, him? Oh, trust me, you don't want to know. These characters' shenanigans became less amusing after I heard their backstories. I was starting to get real nervous about the show, thinking that maybe these guys wouldn't be able to relate to my material. How could they be expected to understand the difference between cats and dogs, or the difference between Los Angeles and New York, if they didn't understand the difference between right and wrong? I was shown into a room where I met the entertainment director. Listen, pal, I want to do good and all, but I think this is a big mistake. You know, when I heard this was a hospital, I imagined sick people. Really sick people. The kind you want nothing to do with. Some of these fellows look healthier than you and me. Oh, don't worry. You'll do fine. We had the Gatlin brothers last week. The Gatlin brothers? I couldn't believe my ears. But then the guy showed me the room, and it was world class with steep stadium seating and perfect acoustics. I'd only seen such a fancy venue one time, and that was for a crowd made up of folks who'd never slaughtered a single man. It was like a broken calculator. It just didn't add up. How is it these monsters deserve such a fancy venue? Well, let me explain something, Norm. You see, technically, all these fellows are not guilty. Not guilty by reason of insanity. Do you understand? No. Every one of these men has been found not guilty in the eyes of the law. Oh. Well, that shed a different light on the situation. If these guys weren't guilty of anything, then they deserved the best show I could give them. I guess I always kind of knew that deep down, but it took the entertainment director to make me realize it. Soon showtime arrived, and I stood in the wings, peering through the curtains. The room was made to hold about 500, but I could see there were only roughly 7 people assembled. Where is everybody? The entertainment director shook his head. I can't figure it. There's not a single other form of diversion in this entire hospital for the criminally insane. And then he looked at me, mean, like it was my fault. It's not my fault, I said. When we had the Gatlin brothers last week, we had to turn people away. Criminally insane people. It broke my heart. Well, get up there, you're on. And he pushed me toward the stage really hard. I hit the stage to silence. Good evening, folks. How many of you here own an answering machine? None of us, that's how many, answered one, and the other 6 grumbled in assent. You got any complaints? Tuesday morning's meeting's the time to bring 'em up, Kowalski, you know that. Now pipe down and let the man speak, said a guard. Anyhow, I continued, I got one, and they're more trouble than they're worth in many ways. Now, say a man phones you, and I just couldn't go on. One of the criminally insane men had found his way onto the stage and had begun biting my leg hard, and the guard had begun striking him with the business end of a baton. But that just caused the criminally insane man to dig his teeth in deeper. I started shrieking, and the audience got a big kick out of that. So the other patients began to wander into the auditorium to see what the commotion was. And by the time they finally shed my leg of the criminally insane man's teeth, the place was full, with everybody clapping and cheering and biting. It was the greatest show I ever had. Chapter 10, Star Search. Star Search was a show where they searched for stars. The show had different categories, such as junior dancers, spokespersons, singers, and comedians. Once a year, they would do a special international star search, where they would gather up a bunch of foreigners and try to make them stars. That's why they contacted me. I was a foreigner. The good news was, if I won, I'd go from a nobody to a star. Sam Kinison had told Dennis Miller about me, told him I was international. And Dennis, who was a very generous man, helped me, as he would many times in my career. Dennis passed my information on to the show's host, Ed McMahon. Ed was famous for sitting beside Johnny Carson and laughing his deep, genuine laugh at all that Johnny uttered. If you're the best at something, you become a rich man, and Ed McMahon was very rich. The show had 4 judges, one of whom was Robin Leach. The judges would judge you by giving you between 1 and 4 stars. These stars would be added together and divided by 4 to yield your score. So, if you were awarded 4 stars, that was the perfect score. That meant each of the judges gave you 4 stars, which I was pretty sure I would receive. I was backstage with my agent and a bunch of dirty foreigners. I was one of them, but only technically, because I was from Canada. In Canada, everything we watch on TV and buy in stores is American, and also we speak the same language. I never felt like I was in a different country when I was in the United States. My opponent's name was the Bushman. He was very funny, and backstage he had us all in stitches. He was from Africa and wore a multicolored tribal robe with a matching hat. He couldn't have looked more out of place in America, and I couldn't have looked more in place. At first, I thought this gave me an enormous advantage, but then I had a second thought. Perhaps this out-of-placeness would actually work in the Bushman's favor. After all, this was international Star Search, and Canada was well known as the least international of all countries. My other problem was that none of my jokes were remotely international. Every one of them dealt with a domestic issue of the United States of America. I told my agent I felt I was in big trouble, and he told me that I was being ridiculous, that I was sure to win. My agent often told me something positive like this right before a catastrophe happened. I was backstage in a room we all shared, and I was hungry, but there was nothing to eat, because many of the performers hailed from third world countries and had either ravenously devoured the food or placed it in their pockets. I struck up a conversation with a couple of Nicaraguan junior dancers who were adorably cute, but who began circling me in a way that had me patting my back pocket to see if my wallet was still there. Things were making me extremely agitated, and that can be very bad for a performer. I decided to go outside and go through my pre-show ritual. Since I started stand-up, I have used the following pre-show ritual as a way of controlling my nerves and centering myself. First, I close my eyes and take a deep breath. Then, I create a picture in my mind. It is always the same picture. I am lying in a glade near a brook while a gentle breeze licks my face and makes me smile. Birds fill the sky with song as I lounge beside the brook with my golden lab and watch the fish as they jump out of the water and back in again. I walk leisurely to the water and take a long, deep drink of it, and it always is clean and cold and slakes my thirst. Then I lie down again on the grass and let my golden lab lick my face, and then I wrestle with him and laugh. Then I open my eyes. This part of the ritual takes about 15 minutes. It never fails to clear my mind, as an eraser clears a busy chalkboard. Then it is time for my body. I stretch, beginning with my calves, and then, without hurry, add to the stretch so that it spreads all the way up my body and finishes with the neck. This is crucial, since I hold most of my stress in my neck. I make sure each stretch is slow and deliberate. And as I perform the stretches, I listen through headphones to the calming strumming of the zither, the most relaxing of all musical instruments. With my mind in a state of cheerful slack and my body loosed, it is then time to work on my soul. I take out 6 2-milligram bars of Xanax and slowly swallow them. Then I reach into my back pocket to find my flask, which is always filled with Wild Turkey 101. I upend it into my mouth and drink until I have to stop to gasp for breath. Then I vomit. Then I close my eyes again and think about the dog and the stream and all that shit. Then I end my pre-show routine by punching my agent in the stomach. If you want to become a performer in show business, and that includes modern dance, I strongly advise this pre-show ritual. I was instructed that on International Star Search, I was to perform for 2 minutes, not a second more or a second less. To make sure I stuck to my time, there was a large digital clock in front of me that counted down from 2 minutes to 0. Whenever I performed my stand-up, I had one ironclad rule. I always made sure to begin with my strongest joke, my surefire laugh-getter, my answering machine bit. And so I came right out with it. It got no laughs. This was a big problem. When I had chosen my 2 minutes of material, I had taken into account the laughter of the audience. But there was a complete absence of laughter, and as I finished my final joke, I saw in horror I still had 1 minute and 15 seconds left to perform. I was sweating hard, and my throat was as dry as kindling. I could hear dangerous mutterings from the crowd, much of it in a foreign tongue, and I looked over in a panic to Ed McMahon, who was also not laughing, unless you consider an angry glare a type of laughter. Ed McMahon, the man whose job was to laugh. Ed McMahon, who was put on this earth to laugh. Ed McMahon, who was paid exorbitant amounts of money to laugh. Ed McMahon was not laughing. But I was a pro, and I still had a little over 1 minute to win the crowd back. That's the beauty of stand-up comedy. One moment, the audience may hate you, and the next, you are on its shoulders. I looked out at them. So, you're saying you don't have an answering machine, huh? None of you? I find that very hard to believe. I think you are liars, and I implore the judges to ignore the boos and jeers and hisses that are filling this auditorium and drowning out my voice. These people are filthy foreigners and wouldn't know funny if it bit them in the ass. Show some guts for once in your life, and don't be swayed by this transatlantic mob. Robin Leach, I'm sure you have an answering machine, and agreed on many of the points I've made tonight. I had plenty more to say, but my time had come to an end, so I trundled off stage, where I encountered a very confident bushman, and I wished him luck. My agent was in the wings. I thought it went great, he said. What? They never laughed, not once. You don't understand. You're used to clubs, and this is TV. The studio audience never laughs because they are too intimidated. These things are all sweetened in the editing. Trust me, I've been at this a while, and I didn't hear anything else my agent said, because the bushman had done his first joke, and the audience laughed loudly for 2 straight minutes. When the bushman exited, walking past us, my agent stopped explaining to me how studio audiences never laugh at anything, and ran down the hall, business card in hand, calling out to the bushman. Now, usually after a bad set, you can just leave and buy yourself a steak and a woman and forget the whole thing. But on this show, you had to wait until the end when they announced the winners in all the categories. I wandered around and saw the Nicaraguan junior dancer team, who must have had a bad set too, judging by the way they were sobbing. I told the mother that they should stop, but she explained that her family was very poor and that this was their ticket out of the slums of Managua, but that her son had dropped his sister during their routine, and now their dream was dead. I told her not to worry, that there was no such thing as a junior dancer in real life, that it only existed on this one television show. So, it was all for naught anyway. What's more, I said, not a single thing in life mattered. That seemed to cheer the mother up. It was finally time for me to go back on stage. First, the international spokesmen were judged. Then the international singers. Then it was time for the comedians. I walked out with the bushman, and we received a standing ovation, as well as a chorus of boos. Never had I felt so much hate for me, mixed with so much love for someone other than me. Ed read from the teleprompter, "And now in the comedy division, another hard decision for the judges." This brought the house down. I've been in comedy for a while, but I don't think I've ever heard a bigger laugh before or since. Ed did his best not to join the laughter. I got to give it to him. And he continued on. The Bushman receives 4 stars. The perfect score. Each judge had given him 4 stars. And Norm MacDonald receives 3/4 of a star. I could not believe it. As I left the stage, I did the math. It meant that 3 of the judges had given me 1 star, and 1 judge had given me 0 stars, and I bet dollars to donuts it was that son of a bitch of a Robin Leach. Chapter 11. The Plan. Adam Egan and I sit across from each other in a red plastic booth at the coffee shop in Whiskey Pete's. Now, Whiskey Pete's is a small casino that sits in a small town called Prim, right at the border of California and Nevada, and it's designed for people who can't wait the extra 90 minutes to feed the gamble in their gut. The stakes are low, and the tables are dingy. Every time I'm here, I wonder if some tourist from a faraway land has ever flown into L.A., rented a car, and was on his way to Vegas when the poor bastard saw Prim and Whiskey Pete's and the other couple of casinos and the water parks. And he figured it must be Las Vegas, the oasis in the desert. So he just stayed there the whole week. And when he returned to his faraway home, he told everyone about Las Vegas and how disappointing it was. It has to have happened. Adam Egan and I eat fried bread and molasses, and the waiter says he knows me from somewhere. I point to my hat. No, he says. I point to my jacket. No, he says. I point to my shirt. No, he says. Hey, aren't you the fellow who lives at Sullivan's boarding house, he says, down near the Nickel in Los Angeles? Why, I knew you 2 years ago, and you still owe me a sawbuck. Fine, I say, and pay him the $10. Then I tell him to get us a fresh pot of coffee, and I start to tell Adam Egan my plan. I guess I can't in all honesty call it my plan, on account of the way it came to me all at once, without thinking. I was just standing on stage at the world-famous Comedy Store, getting no laughs, when a picture brightened my mind. It was as if another man's well-thought-out plan had been magically planted in my head. This is the plan, Adam Egan. As you know, I have no money. I am as broke as Christ himself. And this is because I've lost all my money. I've lost all my money on games of chance. But it has come to me that losing all this money has given me something just as valuable. Adam Egan looks puzzled. What is as valuable as money? I pause and look him in the eye. I want him to understand the plan the first time, so I don't have to repeat it over and over again and field all manner of follow-up questions. Good credit, that's what. Debts paid, that's what. I've always paid off my markers, so I have very good credit. And when you don't owe the casino, in a funny way, the casino owes you. I don't follow, says Adam Egan, and he smokes a Marlboro Red and fills his mouth with fried bread and molasses. That's the way it works in Las Vegas. You pay your markers promptly, and you build up trust. See, Vegas works on odds. If you've always lost and paid your markers, odds say you'll just keep on doing the same thing. Adam Egan nods. Yeah, I got you. Sure. But his eyes are dim as dusk, and I know he still doesn't follow. I don't have but $200 to my name, but Las Vegas doesn't know that. I've got a line of credit with the biggest casinos in the city. Why, between the Mirage, Harrah's, Caesars, and the Horseshoe, I have over $1 million in credit. Adam Egan's eyes become marginally less dim. So, we get these casinos to lend you the million, but then we don't gamble with it. We take a powder and drive straight north to old Mexico, he farts loudly. No, Adam Egan. The casinos give you chips, and you can only use the chips to gamble, and if you win, you must pay off your markers and can only keep your winnings. Adam Egan smiles and nods wisely, and when he does, molasses drips slowly down onto his chin and then begins to harden. So, the plan is to win, then. Well, of course, that's always the plan, but this time, it's only Plan A. You see, I have a Plan B. I've never had a Plan B before, but this time I do. Adam Egan puts what is left of his cigarette into his mouth, but it is very short now, and a full third of it is orange ember. He tries to pull the cigarette from his mouth, but it is stuck to his molasses-covered lips. So instead, his fingers slide down and fix upon the ember. It takes him a considerably longer time to feel the pain than a smarter man would take, but when he does, he jumps to his feet and yelps loudly. He digs at the ember embedded in his thumb until it finally dislodges. "Son of a bitch bastard!" he shouts, and an uproar of laughter fills the coffee shop at Whiskey Pete's. Adam Egott finishes his fine burlesque with a stupid smile to the laughing patrons. I wait with the patience of Job. Plan A, I bet my million until I have a million in profit. Then I quit gambling forever. I quit everything. I'm a certified, genuine millionaire. I buy a ranch in Montana and sit on my porch all day and drink Wild Turkey 101 and watch other men work for me. Well, that sounds like heaven, Adam Egott says, one hand on his sore lip, the other in a glass of ice water. Yes, I say, but a heaven where I am God and the men who work for me are men. What's Plan B, says Adam Egott. Plan B is to lose the entire million. I study Adam Egott's face for a reaction to my provocative comment. But then I see in his eyes that a delayed, more powerful wave of pain is hitting his small brain. Ow! He screams, and the coffee shop explodes in laughter once again, as Adam Egott jumps to his feet and begins to dance from table to table. I wait again. I have the patience of Job. And when he's finally done, I tell him the rest of Plan B. Have you ever heard of a script doctor, Adam Egott? Sure, Norm. Those are those smart fellows from Harvard who punch up screenplays to make them funnier. I laugh at the innocence. You've been living in Hollywood too long. The real script doctors sell magic. Not cheap. Not cheap at all. There's a drug named Dilaudid. It costs $10,000. A small dose proves lethal. I have a friend in Vegas named Gabe who knows a script doctor who can provide me with this drug. If I lose, I simply put it in my blood, say my prayers, lay down, and die in my free bed. So that's Plan B, huh? Yes. And when I get to heaven, I tell God that I died better than broke. In my last act, I stole $1 million from some of the devil's boys. Well, I figure that ought to impress God just fine. So either way, you win. That's the idea. I can tell it's finally sinking in. Where do I fit in? If I win, you become my head ranch hand and make 5% more money than the other ranch hands and get beaten far less often. Sounds good, Adam Egott beams. Do I get my own horse? No. But what if you lose and kill yourself? Then where do I fit in? I guess that would hurt most men. A guy you've known for 20 years asking what he gets when you toss away your soul in a Las Vegas hotel room. But I understand the ways of men, all right. Everybody's in it for himself. Adam Egott's just like everyone else. And my Plan B also takes care of him after I murder myself in cold blood. You're the one who finds me dead, and you cry and shake like a little girl, the way you did just a minute ago. Then later, you write a book about me, and they pay you money. But I can't write. I'm not smart enough. Don't worry about that, Adam Egott. For idiots like you, they provide a ghostwriter. A ghostwriter is a man blessed with bright talent, but cursed with dim luck. The brilliant ghostwriter will do all the work and receive a pittance, while you, an illiterate fool, will be given a king's ransom. Ha ha! That's God's great joke, my son.
My name's Keen. I'm a ghostwriter. Nothing you have read in this book has been written by Mr. McDonald. That is my job, to write these sorts of books for these sorts of people. But this one I was excited about. I was a very, very big fan of Norm McDonald. Was.
Chapter 12. Me, Gabe Veltri, and a Squid. Like all ugly things, Fremont Street is uglier when the sun is bright. This Saturday noon, it is scorchingly ugly. "Why are we downtown?" whines Adam Egott. "You'll see," I say, reaching over to lean on the horn. A moment later, a man emerges from an apartment building and walks briskly toward us. The man is Gabe Veltri, a professional poker player. He makes a fine living at the Aria Poker Room playing Limit Hold'em, where he joylessly books his 60 hours a week. When the market tumbled a few years back, Gabe went bottom feeding and snatched up a property here on Fremont Street, where the hustlers and whores beg and cajole. When he's in Vegas, this is his home, except for the times I'm in town, and then he stays with me in my comped suite. What I like about Gabe is there's no gamble in him. We walked by a roulette table at Caesar's one time, and when I asked Gabe to guess the number, he said 26, and the wheel spun, and lo and behold, the little silver ball landed on 26. We hadn't placed a bet, but the table had heard his guess, and everybody was going nuts. I said, "Gabe, how much do you wish you'd bet a grand on 26? "Not at all," he said, and kept walking. Now that's rare, and I'll tell you what's even rarer. I've never heard Gabe tell that story. It's not even a story to him. Gabe is just the kind of wingman a guy like me will need for my plan to succeed. Gabe will keep me grounded. He'll shame me so I stay away from the pits. I've decided I'll only bet sports, and that I won't go near the tables where the serpents lie in coil to offer me free meals and free rooms and other expensive things. This will allow me the time I need to properly handicap the day's games. I decide to bet mostly on baseball, because baseball is the easiest sport to predict. Why did I insist on Adam Egott coming along on this trip? It's not because he's a friend. My plan has no place for friends. It's not because of his pretty green eyes, either. The fact is that Adam Egott, the dolt's dolt, possesses a particular type of magic. Adam Egott knows nothing about sports and will often say things like, "Why do different baseball teams wear different uniforms? That doesn't seem fair." Or, "Why do they call it a hockey stick anyways?" But Adam Egott can pick winners. Out of the blue, he'll go into a sort of a trance. And then, the way a robot might, he'll suddenly pronounce, "The New York Rangers will win their hockey match tonight." Or, "The Indianapolis Colts will win their football match tonight." And he'll have me scrambling to call my bookie. The problem is, he does this type of thing very rarely, and without warning. But when he does, he is always right, always. He's like that squid that picks the winner of the World Cup once every 4 years. Is very good at exactly one thing. The rest of the time, Adam Egott is just a stupid squid. Gabe slides into the back seat of the Challenger. "Gabe, Adam Egott. Adam Egott, Gabe." With pleasantries taken care of, it is time to be on our way. "Listen, boys, before we hit the strip, what do you say we go to the El Cortez and get some fried bread?" The fellows think this is a capital idea, and so we go and eat breakfast and talk, like civilized gentlemen in the middle of this jungle of vipers. I notice as we drink our coffee that Adam Egott's eyes are not on Gabe or on me. He is looking beyond us, somewhere in the middle distance. I just assume he is gazing at his bleak and certain future. But no, I turn my head and see he is staring at a lady, was waiting to be seated. She is dressed sexy as hell, in a tight dress and high heels. "Fellows," Adam Egget says, "I think I'll go and introduce myself to the future, Mrs. Adam Egget." I wish him good luck, and watch as he approaches her, as he offers her a cigarette, as he stands too close to her. But she doesn't seem to mind. Wonder if he'll close the deal. What are the odds, Gabe? Gabe hasn't been paying attention, as the fry bread and molasses has arrived, but he looks over and studies the pair closely. Well, Norm, to answer your question, I'd say the odds are good, but the goods are odd. No way. Seriously, Gabe? You think that's a dude? Well, look at the way she dresses and talks and moves. You ever see a lady act that sexy? Gabe is right. Only dudes act as sexy as this lady. I better go warn Adam Egget. But it's too late. They are gone. Gabe and I head over to the Mirage. It makes me feel strong as I walk the floor and easily pass the blackjack and craps tables, feeling no pull. It helps to have Gabe beside me, knowing that if I stop at a table, he'll call me a jackass. When we get to my suite, I pull out my laptop and scour the baseball standings to find any trends. I'll be up early the next day to see the Pinnacle lines. Pinnacle is an offshore betting site that always has truer odds than Vegas. Information is everything. I am proud to see that Gabe is proud of me. Gabe tosses me the drugs. So, I'm interested to hear a plan that needs 10K worth of diluted. Well, I'm trying to play smart this time, Gabe. You see, I'm playing for my life, and if I win, I'm a millionaire. I take out the Surettes and the brochures from Montana and explain my plan. Gabe looks at me for a long time and then smiles. So, you bet a million and you either win a million or lose everything, including your life. It's double or nothing. I like it. Double or nothing. Only Gabe would think of it that way. And we laugh together at whatever it is men laugh at when all else is lost. We order way too much room service, which is what men do when food is comped. And as soon as we hang up the phone, there's a knock on the door and one of us says, "That was fast," which is what men say when that happens. It is Adam Egget. "Hey, why didn't you phone? I told you I lost my BlackBerry, remember? It has my sponsor's number on it. But I didn't drink. One day at a time, right?" "Right, right. I thought you'd end up at one of those tiny chapels with some Elvis impersonator marrying you and that dude," I say. "That was no dude. Her name was Sammy, with an I, and she was crazy in the sack, real aggressive." "Yeah, whatever. Get yourself a soda while we wait for the room service." "Oh, thanks, I will. But she's definitely not a dude." Look at the coffee table. Tell me what you see, Adam Egget. "It's a wine glass full of nickels." "That's right. You will use those nickels to play your favorite game." Adam Egget's face lights up like a child's birthday cake. "Video Kino?" "Yes, Video Kino. But first, you use a few of the nickels to buy the Las Vegas Review-Journal and look at the sports lines. And if you find a winner, you tell me, okay?" "Sure, boss. Sure. I'll start right now." So Adam Egget goes and returns with a newspaper and scans the next day's lines, but he falls into no trance and finally grows tired of it and turns to the funny pages to read Marmaduke, and he laughs really hard. Then he sees the food that's arrived in his absence and fills his face with shrimp and steak. He eats fast, like gluttons do, and much of the food spills from his mouth and falls to his shirt. Gabe is on his iPad running simulations of something, and I lie back on the couch and take stock of myself. I feel great excitement at what lies ahead. The enormity of the stakes, the idea of a game being played for life and death, does not sober me, but instead does the opposite. I feel drunk with confidence. A simple piece of logic convinces me I will win. I cannot conceive of my own death, and since a loss would result in such, it follows that I cannot conceive of my own loss. My father passed away many years before my gambling compulsion was born. He would not have approved. Every Sunday when I was a boy, my Aunt Laura would buy a lottery ticket, always making sure she used the identical numbers. The ticket only cost a dollar, but my father called it foolishness and often counseled my aunt to quit this habit. One Sunday, my aunt was over for dinner, and as we were finishing dessert, she jumped from her chair. "Oh, my goodness! I almost forgot to get my ticket! I better go before Barclays closes!" "Oh, why don't you skip it this week, Laura?" my dad said. "But I can't," said my aunt. "They're my lucky numbers. What if I were to skip this week and my lucky numbers hit?" My dad wiped some gravy from his lips and looked at his sister. "Well, Laura, if that were to happen, I would say they were not your lucky numbers. I would say they were your unlucky numbers." Well, I busted a gut at that one. I look over at Gabe and think he would have liked my dad. Gabe always tells me, luck is for losers. I plan to keep this firmly in my mind whenever I feel lucky, whenever I feel I can beat a dealer or a croupier. The money will all come from the sports book. I know that with patience and research, I can beat the odds. After all, I had beat the odds before, again and again. For blackjack or baccarat or roulette, you need exceedingly good luck, but nowhere near the luck it takes to succeed in show business without a shred of talent. So I sit the boys down and explain to them how a punk doing stand-up comedy in Canada decided to go to Hollywood and roll the dice on Mr. Johnny Carson. Chapter 13, The Tonight Show, starring Johnny Carson. Adam Egan has pity all over his face and in his stupid voice. "But I thought you already went to Hollywood to go on that show where they search for stars. But you lost. Just imagine if you had won." "Well, it's like that expression, Adam Egan. Everything happens for a reason." "I've never heard that expression." "You haven't? It's a very, very famous and popular expression. Women are particularly fond of it." "I don't even know what it means," says Adam Egan. "So everything happens for a reason? I never knew. Everything happens for a reason. So there's some secret reason I ate that bowl of Frankenberries for breakfast?" "You know something? You make it hard to tell a story. But I will go on. As I was saying, everything happens for a reason," I say, and then I tell my story. After my Star Search debacle, I stayed in Los Angeles and worked at the Improv, the world-famous Comedy Store, and the Laugh Factory. I had decided to take a break from the road, to try to perfect my material at the L.A. clubs. Every night, I went on stage, and afterward I hung out and talked to the audience, answering their questions, which were always the same. "What is the Bushman like in real life?" "Do you think the Bushman will come here tonight?" "If the Bushman does come here tonight, would you mind taking a picture of him with me?" I met some great comics in Los Angeles, and the best one, and the one who became my friend and hero, was Rodney Dangerfield. Many a night I sat at the back of the Improv, watching Rodney the way a dog watches a man, or a man a god. This guy was the complete package. He looked funny, he talked funny, he even moved funny, tugging at his tie and wiping sweat off his brow. And all the while, his comically bulging eyes shifted nervously from side to side. He wrote the best jokes any comic has ever written. But that's news to nobody. I know another side of Rodney. I've got the inside scoop on big-time celebrities, and one of them is Rodney Dangerfield. Soon after meeting Rodney, when he was at the peak of his career, I learned a very distressing truth. And that truth was that success and money mean nothing when it comes to achieving happiness. From an outsider's perspective, it seemed Rodney had everything. Money, success, fame. But there was one thing Rodney Dangerfield was never able to attain, and it plagued him his entire life. The ugly little secret in Hollywood was that Rodney Dangerfield never got any respect. Now, I know that's hard to believe, but hear me out. Every story Mr. Dangerfield told me was more heartbreaking than the last. It had all started when he was a child, and his father told him that his dying wish was to have little Rodney sit on his lap. I thought it was such an adorable thing for a father to tell his son. I really did. Until Rodney informed me, his dad was sitting in the electric chair at the time. Rodney's mother now had to raise the boy alone and decided to get him a dog. But she didn't think the dog would play with a tot such as Rodney unless she tied a pork chop around the boy's neck. Rodney finally grew up and became a man, but things didn't improve. One time, he recalled, a hooker informed him, "Not tonight, I have a headache, okay?" Imagine hearing that from a prostitute. I told Rodney that when I felt the whole world was against me, I'd find a tavern where a bartender would always lend an understanding ear. But Rodney said he tried that once, and that when he asked the bartender for a double, the bartender brought out a guy who looked just like Rodney. Rodney told me story after story, and each had an identical theme. Rodney Dangerfield, famous, wealthy, comedy superstar, just didn't get any respect. No respect at all. Are you kidding me? I suggested a therapist, and a sad look came into Rodney's roomy eyes. He had seen one, yes, and the therapist, and I use the term very loosely, said Rodney was crazy. Rodney demanded a second opinion, and the cruel psychiatrist told him that he was ugly as well. I felt so bad for my friend and hero. I wanted to tell him how deeply I respected him, both as a man and as an entertainer, but I knew Rodney would only think I was mocking him. Then one night, I got the most frightening phone call of my life. Rodney had begun to feel that perhaps it was his fault that he never received any respect, and, disconsolate, he decided to end it all. He told me over the phone that in a fit of despair, he had swallowed a bottle of sleeping pills. "Rodney," I screamed into the phone, "please listen, you must get to a doctor." "I just left his office, Norm. He told me to have a few drinks, try to get some sleep, all right? Okay." I didn't want to tell Rodney, but I thought that was one of the most disrespectful things I'd ever heard a doctor suggest. But Rodney already knew all too well. When he was away from the spotlight and alone with me, he would tell me his secret truth, all summed up in one sad sentence. "I tell you, Norm, it's a story of my life, all right? I get no respect, no respect at all." And so it went with Rodney Dangerfield. It reminded me of that line in the scriptures, "What doth it profit a man if he gains the whole world, but don't get no respect, no respect at all? Are you kidding me?" I was also pretty down during this time. I felt I'd had my big chance on Star Search and blown it. In my dreams, I often saw the angry eyes of Ed McMahon. But one fateful night, while watching The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson, everything at once became diamond clear to me. My melancholia lifted, and I was overcome with joy and hope. What did I care about Ed McMahon? The world didn't revolve around Ed McMahon. The world revolved around the man sitting to his immediate left every night at 11:30, the king and the kingmaker, Johnny Carson. I knew I had to get on The Tonight Show, and I knew in that moment that I would. I knew deep in my soul that Johnny would make me an overnight star and that it would happen very soon. I drank a handle of bourbon that night, alone and in glory. Late in the fall of 1991, things were different for comedians. Johnny Carson could make your career with a wave of his hand. Here's how it worked. You went out there, you did your 6 minutes, and if Johnny liked you enough, he'd wave his arm, inviting you to join him at his desk, and you'd sit beside him, and he would anoint you, and you would become a star. No other man could do that. Problem was, Carson had already announced his retirement, and my time was running out on being anointed. But every time I went on stage in Los Angeles, my chances of getting on Carson increased, and I was doing as many sets as possible. It was near Christmas when I came off stage at the world-famous Comedy Store and was approached by a small, unassuming man. You can spot a big shot in Hollywood because he wears a pinstripe suit and chews on a fat cigar. He is never unassuming. He's always assuming as hell. "Hi, my name's Jim McCauley, and I'm the talent booker for The Tonight Show," the man said. Hollywood is a town filled with fakes and phonies, charlatans and mountebanks, just waiting to take advantage of a country hick like me. I quickly deduced that this Jim McCauley character was about as authentic as a pound of pimento loaf. So I decided two could play that game. "Is that so? Well, it's sure nice to meet you, Jim. My name's Norm MacDonald, and I'm the King of Spain." The man chuckled nervously. He knew I was on to him, but he continued nonetheless. "As you know, Johnny is retiring in May, and he'd really like to break one last comic on the show. Norm, I think you're the guy." "Well, that sounds fine to me, Jim. As a matter of fact, it's been a dream of mine since I started stand-up. But, of course, I'll have to run it by my wife, the Queen of Spain. I'm sure you understand." He laughed again, but he couldn't give up the act. He was in it too deep. "Okay, then. We'll be in touch." He really slipped up there, because he had said we, but he was all alone. "Fair enough. I'll talk to you guys later," I said. The next morning, I got a call from a lady. "Mr. McDonald, I have Jim McCauley for you." "Sorry, never heard of him," I said, before hanging up. The phone rang again. "Mr. McDonald, I have Mr. McCauley, the man you met last night, the man who books comedians to appear on The Tonight Show." "Oh, yes, of course, that Mr. McCauley. Yeah, put him on." I had to admire this guy's persistence. "Hi, Norm. I think I found the perfect date. Second week of January, we have Steve Martin and Elton John. I ran it past Johnny, and he thinks it's great, because you'll be performing in front of him and Steve Martin, and fingers crossed, after your set, you'll be sitting right between them." Oh boy, had this guy done his homework. Steve Martin was my favorite comic, and I always considered Elton John to be a great singer as well as a hot piece of ass. "Well, you see, the thing is this, Jim. January is not the perfect month, because that's when the people of Spain are at their most anti-monarchist. And if I was to leave the country at that point, there could be trouble in the streets. I don't know if you follow Spanish politics, Jim, but the Queen is not well liked by her subjects. But what the hell, you only live once. I'll do it. I'll be on The Tonight Show." "Oh, congratulations, Norm. I think it's going to be dynamite." Well, a few weeks passed, and I got a panicked call from my agent. "Norm, were you supposed to be on the Carson Show tonight?" "Oh, don't tell me that guy is phoning you now. That guy is Jim McCauley, and he books The Tonight Show, you idiot." "Oh, I thought he was just a guy pulling a prank. Tell him I'll do it." "I already asked. He said you're dead in his eyes." Boy, I really blew that one. Every comic's dream. I had it in my hand, and I let it sift through my fingers, because I didn't know how to trust. I got very angry at myself, and in a rage, I returned to Madrid, where I took it out of my subjects by ruling them with an iron fist.
I first met Mr. McDonald 6 months ago in the Random House offices here in the city. My publisher, Julie Grau, introduced us and informed me that he had a story that simply must be told. I'd heard this same speech from Julie many times before about many different people in that very office. There are so many stories that simply must be told, and it's my job to tell them. Besides, as I said, I was a fan of his back in the 90s and was curious